You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy Thursday, beautiful country. How's everybody doing on another frigid, cold day across this beautiful country? What do we expect? It is January. It is not news here. I love talking about the weather. It just happens to be January in Canada, and people are like, it's so cold. It's like, yes, because we live in Canada. Anyway, here we are. But things may be warming up. The Great Reopening, the sequel, is starting. The Great Reopening, the sequel, is starting in Ontario. And just minutes ago, as you probably heard on some radio stations that carried it, and if you are not in Ontario, if you're in Quebec, all provinces are starting to lift. And Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, literally just outlined what he's going to do. And it is another three-phase reopening, January 31st. So 10 or 11 days from now, indoor public settings, 50% capacity. Indoor public settings, 50% capacity in 11 days. Here's what the Premier said about that.
Starting January 31st, businesses in Ontario will return to 50% capacity. For the first step, arenas, concert venues, and theaters will be capped at 500 people. Social gatherings will increase to 10 people indoors and 25 people outdoors.
That's step one. Now, if everything goes right, Ontario will then go on February 21st, right, to phase two. And what happens on phase two? Well, no cap limits where a proof of vaccine is required. Now, this is a really interesting thing. We don't know whether a proof of vaccine is now two shots or three shots. As I understand it, and Colin DeMello is going to join me, it's just going to be two shots. And then on March 14th, all capacity limits in all indoor public settings will be lifted. But a vax passport, as it were, is still required. Now, he was asked about this cautious approach, which, by the way, if you listen to the health science tables, there's real concern about opening at all. So he's clearly trying to strike a middle ground. I actually think he's got this one right, because kids need to be back at school. Businesses, if you just look at the rest of the world, businesses are open. We've got highly vaccinated populations. This should be okay. Here's the cautious approach from the Premier.
We want to do everything humanly possible to avoid having to go backwards. If that means pausing between steps for a few extra days, we won't hesitate to do so.
Businesses are suffering. Like, one of the reasons that we don't cede total control of our society just to the health tables, and we must respect the science, is that public health is a very, and to be fair to the health tables, they're supposed to consider the broadest definition of public health, which includes mental health. But when you have a highly vaccinated population, as we do, and a very high uptake of the booster shots, and frankly, a largely compliant population with restrictions, this seems to me prudent, because businesses can't take it anymore. Businesses are feeling brutal. It's brutal for businesses. So, you know, this step approach, I get. Now, what happens on February 21st, which, by the way, like, this is a month away. But in a month, the Health Minister, Christine Elliott, outlined the steps on February 21st.
At this time, we will increase social gathering limits to 25 people indoors and 100 people outdoors, and remove capacity limits in indoor public settings where proof of vaccination is required. Spectator capacity at sporting events, concert venues, and theaters will be permitted at 50% capacity.
Still a long ways away. We're you know, normal is a receding issue, but maybe you can see it. And then by March 14th, now you're getting into the March break, and you can see what's going to happen. Oh, March break, people are going to travel. Then there's going to be a surge, and then there's going to be, you know, the merry-go-round of debates. And I understand the fatigue of all this, but what happens on March 14th? Here's Ontario's health minister, Christine Elliott.
By March 14th, we intend to lift capacity limits in all indoor public settings and religious services and ceremonies, and increasing social gathering limits to 50 people indoors with no limits outdoors. Proof of vaccination requirements will be maintained.
I hope it's warm by March 14th, because you can gather outdoors. I hope it's warm enough to do it. I mean, if you're in Windsor listening to us, you're like, yeah, it'll be fine. But basically, in 11 days, if you want to go to the gym, if you want to go to the movies, if you want to go gambling, at 50% capacity, you can go. So life incrementally returning back to normal. I'll get your thoughts on this, if it's too soon, not soon enough. But again, restaurants, bars, food, drink establishments without dance facilities, retailers like grocery stores and pharmacies, shopping malls, non-spectator areas, sports and recreational facilities, cinemas, meeting places, recreational amenities, amusement parks, water parks, museums, galleries, aquariums, zoos, casinos, bingo halls, 50% capacity. We're getting there. We're getting there. Now, again, like you, I'm probably exhausted talking about this. People are just, we're like that kid who was shoveling snow that CTV News Toronto talked to. Just, he's exhausted and sighing, Travis. Well, we're all like Travis right now with these restrictions. But I actually think this, in some ways, is the best answer. Do you have Travis there?
Tiring.
Oh, it's Carter. Carter, sorry. Sorry, Carter. I mean, I think when we hear about another restrictions, we all summon our inner Carter. I think when we hear about waiting till March to go back to normal, we all summon our inner Carter.
Tiring.
I think when you think 11 more days of this, you think. By the same token, talk to the people. Dr. Uni on the health table is deeply concerned that we're moving too quick. And part of the reason is that the term peak, like, have we reached the peak of the pandemic? A peak gives us lay people the impression that it's kind of over. Okay, worst is behind us. Let's go. But what happens are two things. One, a peak can last for a long time. Number two, hospitalizations lag behind peaks. So people say, well, I looked at the wastewater. I looked at, we're getting fewer people getting COVID. But that doesn't mean that the hospitalizations can be 10 days behind that. So you might get a spike of hospitalizations. I always like to say, I read a lot of books on climbing, like Mount Everest, you know, the John Krakauer type books, in the thin air. Almost as many people have died descending Mount Everest as ascending. In other words, once you hit the peak, it's still dangerous going down. And so there will be a lot of deaths going up to the peak, but after the peak, a lot of deaths going down from the peak. And that's where we may well be. I'm not sure we are, but we may well be. But how do we make these determinations? And will the vaccine passport change from two doses to three? Because you know that COVID, that Omicron, two doses is good, three doses significantly better. Will that change? I don't think so. But Colin DeMello standing by to lay out the lifting of restrictions. And then I'll get your thoughts on that. But what are the impacts of this, and how is this happening, and why is this happening now, and are we at peak, and what's the beds? How many staffing beds do we have in hospitals versus how many funded beds? As we've heard on this program before, having the beds without the staff is like owning a car without gasoline. It may as well be a brick. So how does that impact what could be the peak in hospitalizations? Colin DeMello breaks it down on the other side of a break. Stay with us.
finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Ontario lays out the three phased in lifting of restrictions, and there's going to be a debate. Too soon, not soon enough. Let's break it all down in the debate around how this works. The justification for the great reopening, the sequel. Colin DeMello, CTV Queen's Park Bureau Chief, joins us. Colin, great to have you back on the program. The Premier was just on. January 31st, indoor public settings, 50% capacity. Arenas capped at 500 people. Social gatherings increased to 10 people indoors, 25 people outdoors. Why the date? What did he say to justify when and how this is all happening?
Well, they didn't really give us a clear indication of why they're picking the 31st of January, other than to say that the premier, you know, made a promise that these were going to be time-limited measures, Evan, and so they want to kind of start the reopening as soon as possible. But we're getting kind of some conflicting words here from the premier, the chief medical officer of health, and the minister of health. So the premier said today that we can confidently say, in his words, that the worst of Omicron is behind us. Yet the chief medical officer of health says February is going to be a very challenging time for the province. And the minister of health says we're going to see the peak of ICU admissions happen only in the middle to late part of February. So it's you know, quite an interesting timetable to see that they're reopening restaurants, bars, gyms, and all sectors of the economy at 50% in January when, you know, it seems like the worst is not really behind us. It is yet to come.
Now, Colin, let's talk about that. And I was speaking about it before. As I understand it, there's hospitalizations have about a 10-day, two-week lag. So you get a peak, and then you get sort of within 10 days a lag, and then you see this peak in hospitals and ICUs. Is that so? That's why I was trying to figure out the math on that. If they open on January 31st, that may have been the peak already in terms of the infections, but it doesn't show up in the ICUs for another 10 days, 2 weeks. So sort of February, and that is why they've opened. Now, I don't know what the health table says about that, but is that the math that they're using?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the calculation here, right? I mean, at this point, we're starting to see already the hospitalizations kind of may have hit some kind of a peak, right? Like earlier this week, we had 4,100 people in hospital. We're still above 4,000, but for two straight days now, those numbers have slowly been declining. The other key thing that the chief medical officer of health said was that the length of time people are staying in hospital, the length of time people are staying in ICU is not as long as it would have been with the Delta variant, right? It's like a couple of weeks less compared to the Delta variant. And so I think they're kind of making a number of calculations here. Even though people are entering hospital, they're staying in hospital for a shorter period of time. They're seeing the percent positivity start to come down. They're seeing everything start to either stabilize, plateau, or head in a downward trajectory. So I think that's why they're kind of, you know, looking at this like a crystal ball saying, okay, well, if it's coming down now, it could dramatically drop a little bit later on.
Tell me, so now I guess the question is there must be some experience on the math of this, that if you only open indoor public settings at 50% capacity, you do not get a spike. Is there any data on that?
Well, you know, the province throughout this entire pandemic has kind of learned that if you go slow and you're kind of cautious about everything, you tend to avoid the worst case scenario. And this has actually been a tried and true kind of formula that the province has applied, right? So instead of opening up everything right away, they kind of go in increments.
The stage process,
They step back. They kind of take a look at what impact it's actually had before taking another step forward. So that's the same, you know, idea that they're using here, which is slow and steady will win the race, as opposed to just opening up everything all at once. The science advisory table has said a couple of things, though. One, you have to examine the impact of what's happening with schools. And I don't know if this is going to give us enough of a window to be able to examine the impact. And two, they said if you open up too quickly, you're going to trigger another wave of Omicron. And that's what they're looking to avoid. So we're going to have to touch base with the science advisory table to see. And they're always, you know, pretty upfront about it, about what this could potentially do. So we'll hear from them, I'm sure, in the hours and days to come.
Yeah, I mean, you got some members of the round table, like Dr. Peter Uni, who are, they seem a significantly more ambivalent about this, don't they?
Well, one of the things Dr. Uni said to me was, you know, it's unavoidable with the Omicron variant. It's so highly infectious that he said to me, quote, unless you're a hermit, you're going to catch this. But here's what he said. It's better to catch it later rather than sooner, because if you catch it later, you're going to be, if you need hospitalization, chances are there will be a hospital bed available for you. Right now, you know, it is a bit iffy. So I think they're kind of looking at this from a very different perspective, right? Because it's not as virulent as the Delta variant, which is why they all kind of feel this weird comfort level with the Omicron variant that they didn't before.
Okay, so talk about the impact on businesses in the province of Ontario. Speaking of Colin DeMello, the CTV Queen's Park Bureau Chief, on the reopening plan on starting in 11 days from now. Phase 1 in Ontario, February 21st, will be a Phase 2 approach. And if all goes well in March, there'll be a Phase 3 approach. Colin, you know, it's a kind of an interesting, as they're doing that, the impact on restaurants, bars, businesses, retailers, they're hanging on by a thread. Are they pushing the Premier to open now, or are there concerns?
Well, they were looking to open as quickly as possible, even if it was with a capacity limit, right? And that's because they've been closed for so many times during this pandemic that they're finding themselves in a tenable position. But also, they're looking for some kind of metrics or data to let them know for sure, okay, on the 21st, we're going to be reopening with no capacity limits. You know, for lack of a better term, I think a lot of these restaurants have been feeling jerked around for the last number of years. And so what they're looking for more so above all is just certainty, right?
Yeah.
You know, if the 21st is going to be the date that they open up with no capacity, that means they have to purchase a lot of additional inventory. They've got to make sure they have the right amount of staff on hand. They've got to do a lot of work to prepare. And if all of a sudden, 2 days before, the government says, no, we're going to kick this can down the road, that obviously means losses for them one way or the other.
Mind you, they still could kick it down. Like, and again, just to be clear to everyone, these opening stages are not written in stone. They can pull back, according to the Premier, right?
Yeah, the Premier said, you know, if they start to see hospitalizations rise, case numbers rise, they could move the date by what he said was a few days here or there. But I think ultimately that's what restaurants are looking for, right? Certainty that, A, if they're going to open, that they're going to stay open and they're not going to have this open-shut cycle that they've been going through. And B, just a little bit of clarity in terms of what data is driving the decision so they can follow along as well, right? So they can say, oh, hey, hospitals have hit 2,000. Okay, we know for sure we're not going to extend this closure. And we get none of that data, unfortunately.
Before I let you go, Carl, what about the vaccine passports? Will they be bumped up from 2 shots to 3 shots? Is that the requirement soon?
The Premier was unequivocal. He said no. Although now we're hearing from the Ontario Liberals who are saying, you know, you should include the third dose in the vaccine passport if you want to encourage more people to get their third dose. But the Premier, I mean, he shut it down. His answer was just very curtly no.
But there's no sign that these are going away. You're still going to need these.
Right. And that's the interesting thing. I mean, in the earlier plan that they had originally proposed, January 17th was supposed to be the day that vaccine passports were eliminated. And by March 28th, we were even going to get rid of the masking mandate in Ontario. Today, though, there is no mention of the masking mandate. There's no mention of when the vaccine passport requirement would be lifted. And in fact, they say even after the third and final step of this reopening on March 14th, vaccine certificates will still be required at the places where they are required now. So we don't know when they're going to be removed, and we don't know what the metrics will be for them to actually be finally taken away.
You're the best, man. Colin DeMello, CTV Queen's Park Bureau Chief, on the big reopening in Canada's largest province, the Stage Pro. Thanks, bud. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Colin DeMello, get your thoughts on that. We just heard from Colin. We've heard from Doug Ford. We've heard from the health minister. Do you agree with lifting restrictions in this way? 1-855-633-1010 and 71010. Your calls next on The Evan Solomon Show. Stay with us.
As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
It is the big debate across the country, province by province, depending what's opening. Today it happens to be Ontario, where the Premier, Doug Ford, announced that as of January 31st, the Great Reopening Part 2 will happen. So you've got January 31st, February 21st, March 14th for the three stages of reopening. Stage 1, increase social gathering limits to 10 people indoors, 25 people outdoors. Capacity limits of 50% for indoor public settings, including restaurants, bars, retailers, shopping malls, cinemas. Gyms, you can get back to the gym. And I'm asking you just for your opinion on this. Because we don't know. There's some discrepancy, as Colin DeMello reminded us, between what's the peak. The worst is behind us, according to the Premier. ICU worst could be ahead of us, according to Dr. Kieran Moore. So no one really knows what the hell's going on here, or do they? 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Is it time to ease restrictions in 11 days? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. The texts are pouring in. This affects literally everybody. If you're in Quebec, you can also talk to us, or in British Columbia. You want openings now or not? Everybody's weighing in on this. Everybody is weighing in. Evan, oh my God, this is not soon enough. They need to move faster to open up. Solve the issue causing us to keep lockdowns. More ICU capacity. We are in this situation because our lack of healthcare capacity. Let me just clarify that text. You're right. It's not the capacity of beds. It's not paid beds, funded beds. It is what? Staffed beds. Paul, what's up?
Hi, Evan.
How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing good, good. You know what? I'd love to see everything open up, just as the Premier would as well. But my one concern is that I have three school-age kids. And I'd hate to see them prematurely open, getting people into sports bars and comedy clubs and so on, only come mid-March to have to close the schools again and shut down because, surprise, surprise, the hospitals are full.
Yeah.
So, again, my number one concern from the point of view of a parent is safeguarding the school reopening plan.
Yeah, the jerk and yank on kids is a nightmare, right? You're open,
right.
You're closed. I'm 100% with you. But I don't know if how much longer, keep schools open, but businesses also need to be open, right? They look at your Main Street. Main Streets are starting to look like Bobby Clark's mouth. Half the teeth are knocked out.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. I get it. But and that goes to what the texter was saying earlier. What else are they doing to ensure that, you know, if case counts rise with the reopening, as they surely will, what are we doing to meet the demand to the healthcare system in the meantime? We can't just rely on lockdowns as our only instrument for countering this.
Yeah, Paul, great point. I hope your kids are okay, man. Boy, we haven't
We never talk about
that, do we? I mean, see, I'm getting this. Some people are saying, Jeff texts me, lift restrictions now. Crazy slow government. This is BS. And then Jeff, literally right after you, another text. This is friggin' too soon. This is a political move. Ford wants to get voted back again. This is not the best answer. We'll be back on lockdown. We need to deal with the anti-vaxxers. We are moving too quickly. So you got Jeff saying it's way too slow and someone else saying it's way too quick. Let's go to Gary.
Hey, Evan. Listen, I think that the closures are not working. It's clear by the count that we're having in the ER and the hospitals. What could be working is the better use of the mask mandate and the vaccine passports. I just returned from 2 weeks in the States. All of December, I was out of Canada, and then I went over to Germany. And what they do in Germany is they're very strict on the mask mandate and the passport. If you don't have the passport and you're not wearing a mask, you simply don't enter.
But aren't we doing it just out of interest, Gary? Don't we do that already? Like, isn't that what we're doing? How much stricter can we be on the mask?
I was at Metro the day before yesterday, and there was a guy standing in line at the grocery store to pay. He had no mask on. I didn't say anything. It's not my Metro. They should have had somebody mandating that. These closures are not working, Evan. They're trashing the economy, and a lot of people are sacrificing their business for this. There's got to be a better solution. And there also needs to be a wholehearted reform of the entirety of the medical system in Ontario. It's not working either.
Gary, I appreciate it, by the way. Yeah, let me quickly respond if I can. Look, there are going to be exceptions at the odd metro. Mostly I see the mask mandate is pretty strict everywhere, and we have a vaccine passport. Are the lockdowns working? If you talk to the Quebec government, if you talk to the Ontario government, they have worked. They've slowed down the spread. That's what the medical community is saying, Gary. So, look, it's an interesting point. I don't know if the answer is just stricter mask wearing, because I just don't know where I just don't see where the delta is, where the gap is. It seems like you have to wear a mask everywhere. Jim, Newtonville, what's cooking?
Hey, what's happening, Evan?
You know, love these conversations. This is one of those situations, hey, Jim? We're all in it together.
Yeah, and here's something for you. I work in healthcare, okay? We've got people at our home that have had four shots already, and they still got COVID. The lockdown isn't working, okay? Boris Johnson just opened up the UK because he says lockdowns don't work. You can see the data. You can see the stats. What we have a problem with is our hospitals and our healthcare system. We need more staff. It's going to take several years in order to get the staffing to where you need it. So that's going to be several years. So you're going to tell me that you're going to wait another several years for everybody to stay in lockdown and masks and all the rest of that. The problem with masks, and everybody's getting this, and a lot of people don't realize, if you take your mask off using your hands and you pull it down and put it up on your face and pull it down, you're actually infecting yourself because everything you touch all day, you take it off, put it in your pocket, you're infecting yourself when you take it and put it back on because you're wearing it all day long, every day. And a lot of people don't clean them because I've seen some really nasty stuff. But having said that, every time you touch your face with a mask on, you're touching your face. You're touching near your eyes. That's a route of an entry for your body. That's a route of infection. If you ask any doctor, any epidemiologist, they'll tell you the exact same thing. When we go into residents' rooms, we take the mask off and throw it out. We only wear it once. We don't wear it all day long. Now, everybody's doing this, and they keep touching. You watch anybody. You see the guys that are wearing masks in cars, and they hang them from their mirrors. How clean is that? So everything you've touched now all day, or you take it off and women put it in their purse, everything you've touched all day long in your purse.
Right, I get it. Well, so it's interesting. Just on that, people sometimes say we should compare to the U.S. just and how they've handled it. You may be right, by the way, in the hygiene. I think you're not wrong, and I really appreciate that. Just in Canada in the last 7 days, the death per million, we've got 19 deaths per million. The U.S. has 26 deaths per million. Okay, this is not a comparison of population. So, you know, are our mandates working? We're certainly cutting down on the mortality rates compared to the U.S. Let me try to take one more call. But that's right. Hygiene on masks, I really appreciate that. Amir in Montreal, let's go there. What's your take on the openings or closing?
Yeah, hey, it was an honor talking to, what's your name, Monologue Evan, who doesn't know the meaning of the word debate. Hey, why don't you take on some of the scientists that are on our side, eh? Why don't you debate them?
Why don't you don't come on the show? Listen, I'm happy, Amir, if you want to insult, but it's not Monologue Evan. I've had doctors on. Let me just ask you before you run off your mouth a bit more. Hey, just a second before you run off your mouth. Are you a doctor, Amir? Oh, classic. You're not a doctor. You want me to bring on somebody that you think reconfirms your bias. I literally have on this program, we just listened to the Health Science Table of Ontario. We listen to epidemiologists and doctors. And then you got a guy like Amir who wants to come on and yell and insult. Hey, Amir, go to town, buddy. Are you a doctor, Amir? Click. Do you know what you're talking about, Amir? Click. Do you want to have a real debate, Amir? Click. But Amir wants me to bring on somebody, he won't specify who because he won't stand the line long enough, that reconfirms his bias. I'm sure you've trolled the internet, Amir. I'm sure you've spent a couple hours on the internet and now you think you're a medical doctor. That's not the way it works, buddy. That's not the way it works. I bring on the medical doctors, not Amir, internet troll. Thanks for calling in, buddy. We'll take a break. We're going to go to Iqaluit. They've got a real crisis there. Imagine having no fresh water. That's next.
talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
Hey, welcome. If you're living in Montreal, it's negative 15 today. It is negative 16 if you are living in Ottawa. If you are living in Toronto or the surrounding areas, it is negative 12. If you're living in Vancouver, I know it's 8 degrees. Why am I giving you these numbers? I'm giving you these numbers for one reason and one reason only. However cold you think it is, imagine it being that cold and not having any fresh water, just the basics. You got to boil water because your city doesn't have water. Now take your temperature and minus it by 10 or 20 degrees. Welcome to Iqaluit, where for the second time, there's a boil water advisory. Why? Because the water smells like fuel. Last time that happened, the citizens had to boil water for months and months and months. Boil water to brush your teeth. Boil water to wash your food. Boil water to cook your food. Boil water to make ice cubes. Let me bring on Mayor Kenny Bell, the mayor of Iqaluit. First of all, Mayor, I haven't talked to you in a while. I am just heartbroken to hear this again, and I hope you and your clan are well. What's the sitch there in Iqaluit right now?
Yeah, thank you, Evan, for having me. So, you know, small clarification. The last problem we had was actually a do not consume order for 2 months. So there was, you know, one of the reasons why is because we didn't know what was in the water at the beginning. You know, we found out that it was hydrocarbons. We remediated the situation, but it's something still happening. So, you know, we're pretty sure that it is still an original problem and not a new occurrence. But you know, something that's just residual in the system that is making its way through right now.
So, what do you think has gone wrong now? I thought you'd solved this issue. So, can you give us people background what happened the first time and what's happened now, Mayor Kenny Bell from Iqaluit?
For sure. So, you know, back in October, we found we had complaints about, you know, fuel smell in people's water. And of course, we started investigating right away. Eventually, we found a tank that was buried, you know, some time ago. Last I heard was, you know, 1995 or something like that. You know, there's still an investigation going on for old records, but an oil tank that was buried underground beside our water treatment plant that ultimately gave way to elements and contaminated our one of our tanks. It actually ate through the cement. So, you know, we were on a do not consume for about 2 months, just a little bit over 2 months. And, you know, the government of Nunavut, the government of Canada and the city of Iqaluit worked hard on doing that, very long days. And, you know, we thought that we had fixed everything. Now, there's some caveats, of course, because, you know, we're so remote. We have some issues with staffing, you know, even contractors. We had an environmental cleaning company that there's only one in Iqaluit. And, you know, they left for Christmas vacation. So they started their job before Christmas vacation. They're back now and back to work. They started just the other day. So they're in there right now. And actually, they were there when the hit happened yesterday that ultimately caused us to use the bypass system to make sure that we don't have, you know, fuel in the water anymore.
Yeah. So because of the first disaster, you built this bypass system. Now to talk about that, but the bypass system doesn't mean you can just turn on your tap and drink water.
You know, it will eventually. Right now, it's the boil water advisory is because we have to make sure that the chlorine levels are acceptable, and because it's a bypass system, we want to make sure that the level. I mean, it's hard to tell what the level is, and we have to make sure that we're not overchlorinating the water. So right now, as we're working through the system, in the next couple of days, you know, either we'll have a fix soon, hopefully, but also we will be allowed to drink water normally without the boil water. But right now, we just want to make sure that everyone's safe.
Mayor Kenny Bell, the mayor of Iqaluit, what's it like there? I understand it's like negative 28 there today. How are people getting water?
You know, today is a beautiful day here in Nicalo. It's, you know, minus 28 to us is not bad, especially in January. But no, we have a lot of people are going to the river to pick up water. You know, most people in the city haven't actually smelt any hydrocarbons in their water.
Yeah, but sorry, Mayor, I got to interrupt you, and I appreciate this. For you, you're talking about things that are normal. I just want people across the country, people in Toronto and Windsor and London and St. Catherine and Ottawa and Montreal and Victoria and Kelowna, they're all listening to you, and you're just gliding past. A warm day is negative 28, and people are going to the river to get water. Can you just describe what that means? Because for almost everyone else listening, Mayor, they're like, what are you talking? Who goes to the river to get water in negative 28? What does that mean?
Yeah, so, you know, and actually people have been using river water since the beginning of time here. You know, even as a young teenager and a young man, I used to go collect water in the middle of winter from the same river. What you use is an auger, just like ice fishing, and you just scoop out water. This has been, you know, again, since forever. People did it last year before the water emergency. People will do it well after the water emergency. But right now, it's a lot of people. It's a lot more than normal. You know, it's very common for us to go take water from the river. So it's not like it's an uncommon thing, but it's just
a pain in the butt, though. It's a pain in the butt. You got, is there someone, is your municipality, who uses the auger, who makes the hole, who gets the bucket, or do people just do it themselves? Everyone's just like, it's a DIY sitch. It's like ice fishing. Everyone just goes out there, cranks a hole in the ice, gets on there, brings it to their car or their skidoo and goes home. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. So normally, you know, just any random citizen will just put on the Nicalo PSAs on Facebook and say, you know, the river is open. Right now, the city is also taking water from that river and taking it to our Elders Kamak, which is a building that the elders, you know, gather and hang out and enjoy some cultural events. We have water distribution in that location right now from 3 to 8 every day. And for people that do want to have that water, but we're all that water should also be boiled as well. So there's no real difference between taking it from the tap or from the thing. And you know, this time around, the hydrocarbons were about 50 micrograms, which, you know, is well below the 390 limit the Canadian government allows us to have in our water, which is, you know, in my opinion, crazy in the first place. But, you know, it's the safety issue, I guess. Anything more than 390 is not safe, and anything below is safe. You know, I'm no water expert or engineer, but, you know, people are smelling it at 50 micrograms and tasting it, there's a serious issue.
There's a problem. Like you think the threshold may be too high. How long is this going to last for, Mayor?
You know, we've had a water crisis here for about, you know, almost 6 years now, with not enough water. And we know that our piping and our infrastructure is old. And this plant is from 1962, was built by the Canadian government in the very beginning of our city. You know, we're hoping that this doesn't last very long. Obviously, we want it to be done as soon as possible. All of us live here, our citizens, all of our employees are working hard to make sure that this is done. And you know, we're hoping we'll be done by the end of the week, but, you know, we just don't know right now.
Listen, Mayor Kenny Bell, Mayor of Iqaluit, we keep following the story. Fellow Canadians, there's Canadians, more than 8,000 of them in Iqaluit. They don't even have water. Mayor, take care. Your resilience extraordinary. Thank you, sir. All right, we got to take a break on the Evan Solomon Show. Overhyped and underplayed with Scott Reed is next.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Coming up on the program on hour two, as we get deeper into it, there's a new book out by the great journalist Stephen Marsh called The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. And Stephen Marsh, who's best-selling author, has written a book that looks at possible scenarios for an American Civil War. Quote, the United States is coming to an end. The only question is how. Stephen Marsh will join us. Is it alarmist? What proof does he have? How does he talk about it? And you'll get to weigh in on that. There's chaos down south, but is it a civil war? So Stephen Marsh is saying, yeah. And it's a fascinating book. But before that, it is time for Overhyped and Underplayed.
Overhyped. Create jobs and opportunity.
In this election,
here's what I want to do.
Or Underplayed.
Well, we could have done the next Civil War, but Stephen Marsh is going to join us on the Overhyped and Underplayed on that. But Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator, former DCOM for Paul Martin, joins us. The best tweet of the week, Scott Reed, belongs to your son, but actually via you, the Book of Ben, who said, a snow day we have online school is total BS. I absolutely laughed out loud. It's so true, eh? It's a snow day, school online. Not cool.
Absolutely. And that's no exaggeration. That was, quote unquote, the conversation in the kitchen. My 12-year-old is like standing there and I'm like, okay, so I got to tell you, it's a snow day. And he's like, snow day? Snow day? And I'm like, sled? Outside play, yeah. And then I'm like, but you've got to go online at 9 o'clock, and that went over bad. And then the next day they canceled school again, and I think they finally, like, I think they woke up to reality, and they just said, you know what, actually there's no synchronous online learning, no asynchronous online learning, no like scissored online learning. That's it, just snow day, go out, play, have fun, right. So the kids, you know, I mean, but that's, you know what, I bailed on Monday like at noon. It was like, I'm not making them sit in front of the computer and, you know, talk about isosceles triangles. To hell with this.
I didn't understand. I'm going to be honest with you before we get to this. I did not understand a single thing that you talked about there. Scissors. Like, what are you talking about? What are those terms? Are those online learning terms? Like, I'm a father of two, so I feel like I've suddenly become like the worst. What are you talking about?
Well, that's the whole experience, is that it makes you feel like a crap parent all the time, right? But yeah, you haven't encountered this. There's okay, we're going to have online learning. It's going to be structured online learning. Oh, you know, today we're going to have asynchronous online learning, which is a complicated geometric phrase for we're screwing around. Like, there's no work plan. There's no homework. There's no assignments. Basically, we're just going to put, like, you know, whatever, The Littlest Mermaid and Up on your screens, and the kids are just going to sit there and, you know, asynchronous online learning. Why don't we just hit our kids with oven mitts? You know what I mean?
It's just, I feel like it's that kid. Did you see the kid shoveling, Carter? Did you see Carter Trizzolo?
Yeah, I made my kids do that too. There was a lot of shoveling in my household that day. Yeah. Lots. And they were out there complaining, can we play? I'm like, no, we got to clear the driveway. And then we got to shovel the neighbor's driveway because, you know, there's two sisters. They're maybe not as agile. So we tried to clear their snow out and...
All right, overhyped or underplayed? Can we get overhyped and underplayed? The debate over whether we should reopen. Ontario lays out the three-plan reopening. January 31st, 50% capacity indoor public settings, and February 21st if all goes well. Are we overhyping the concerns, or are we underplaying the concerns of the staged reopening?
We're probably underplaying them, but I'm as guilty as everybody else. At this point, I'm just like, okay, fine. You know what, Uncle? You've got my arm twisted behind me. we gave up on schools. Like I don't understand. There is no grounded logic to anything they're doing now, right? So we know we don't have data because the whole testing approach is just, they basically throwing their arms up. So, you know, we don't have reliable data on testing. The only thing we really know is, you know, how flooded are the ICUs? They say, well, they're not as flooded as they could be today. Oh, okay. Well, that's reassuring, I guess. We'll see where we're at in 10 days. But, you know, like, I wanted school to go back because I saw the kids getting all the harm, but I didn't see the benefit in terms of, is it making things better? We can't measure it. We don't know. Same thing with bars. Like, what, are they just going to keep these people out of work forever? They're not boosting the either federally or provincially, certainly nothing coming from the province, like, the relief they're providing to bar owners, restaurant owners, and certainly to the employees. You know, you make $300 a week if you jump through a bunch of hoops and you're willing to get taxed at the end of the year on that. Like, that's tough for people to, like, get by on, right? So I guess I'm sort of like, yeah, I guess open it up. But let's not for one second be under an illusion that this is guided by science or anything. They're just saying, you know what, we, like, whatever, Uncle, we give. We're just going to open it up.
Not only that, but we don't know when the peak is. The premier said the worst is behind us. The head of the science table, Dr. Kieran Moore, says maybe the worst in the ICUs is to come. I'm not sure if there's a delay or not. But I am kind of with you. I just think, you know what? A staged reopening in 11 days to start. Most of us are vaccinated. Most of us are wearing masks. I know there's the hardcore unvaxxed 10%. I get that. But I think that's where the public's at right now. That's what I think.
I agree with you. I think that's where people are at. They're fatigued. And in the absence of hard data that says this is how bad it will be a week from Wednesday, unless we do this, and this is how good it will be a week from Wednesday if we do, I think people are just like, sorry. And they can't provide us that information, so that's that. I will just say one thing with pure politics. Circle that phrase that you just mentioned. If there's been one big misstep in the last handful of days, Doug Ford today saying the worst is behind us. That's not a scripted phrase. That is something he's going to live to regret. And I know people go, well, you know, like, let's be honest, we got Fred Flintstone for a premier, so we cut him a lot of slack on this stuff. But that's the kind of thing that is just like just begging to bite you in the ass, saying that the worst is behind us when we don't know that and he doesn't know that, that he could live to regret it.
This one, I'm hesitant to say overhyped or underplayed, but there is a genuine fear that Russia is going to invade Ukraine. I don't know what their motive is. They annexed Crimea in 2014. They've got 100,000 troops staged at the border. Our foreign affairs minister is there. The Secretary of Defense in the U.S., they're concerned that there's going to be an invasion. And then there's a debate about whether we should send military weapons, defensive weapons to Ukraine. Are we overhyping this or underplaying the geopolitical significance?
I think both. I'll start with we're underplaying it because you have to look at what's happening. It's a very real threat. I think he's testing the world. He's particularly testing Biden, and he's relying on a world that says we are beleaguered as national leaders by the weight of helping our populations through COVID. The idea of acting internationally, putting, you know, money and lives on the line to try to stop Russian aggression in a place that maybe not everybody really cares that much about. He's counting on all that to sort of conjure up a sanguine response. But it's a real issue. And this guy's no good, and he's got to be stopped. So we have to take a firm line with him. The reason I would say we maybe are overhyping it is I think at the end of the day, he will blink. I think at the end of the day, he will not. Now, I'm not, you know, talk to 20 people and 21 of them will be more expert in international relations and military affairs than me. But I think he just wants, I think right now, this feels to me like a dry run. This feels to me like he's testing the world. He's going to take it right to the line, then he's going to back down. One of the reasons is that even though he's an autocrat, there isn't a lot of domestic political support for it in Russia. And I think that does matter.
I just don't see the strategic imperative. What, does he want to own that part of Ukraine? They've already been there inside eastern Ukraine in the Donbass. And guess what? They lost a lot of soldiers. It's a nightmare. I don't see what the strategic value is. But he is testing Biden, and Biden screwed up yesterday when he said, you know, we'll respond wholeheartedly, but if it's an incremental incursion, maybe not. It's like, dude, wrong thing to say. I don't. And then he had to take it back last night. Yeah. It was a bumble by Biden. We've seen that before. I was stunned by that. Overhyped or underplayed real quick, Jagmeet Singh. He said he's realized the error when his wife was gifted an $1,800 rocking chair. And she's an influencer. And then he puts it on Instagram. I got 10 seconds. Is he in trouble or not?
Overhyped. Do not apply the word corruption to this, as I've seen people do. This is too insignificant event to apply that word. It's a violation. It's not corruption.
Keep on rocking in the free world is how I described it for him. Scott Reed, send my best to Ben. Thanks, buddy.
All right. Take care, bud.
All right. Lots to come. We got a great story coming up about nuclear waste. You need to hear this.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
Look, there's a big debate about the future of energy. Are we going to do fossil fuels? Are we going to go green? And there's climate change. And one of the big debates is the use of nuclear energy. 70% of the power in France, nuclear energy. But after what happened in Japan, remember the Fukushima incident? People are worried about it. Ontario has a lot of nuclear energy plants. The big question is what to do about nuclear waste. And now there's a proposal that could see up to 30,000 shipments of spent nuclear fuel rods that are radioactive, and these would be on trucks starting in 2040, that would basically be transporting them to a storage facility that they're building. But that means trucks carrying highly radioactive spent nuclear fuel rods are going to travel on the roads. Truck beside you on the highway, maybe in through your city. Now, is it safe? The nuclear industry says yes. And so to talk about this, because this is always the kind of thing people are like, you know what, we should use nuclear energy. But then there's a NIMBYism. Would you like trucks carrying spent nuclear fuel rods on the highway near your house? Well, Caitlin Burley is the Nuclear Waste Management Organization's Manager of Transportation Engagement. So this is what Caitlin does. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. How are you today?
Well, listen, I'm great. This is everyone says, okay, we need more energy. Nuclear energy should be used. But what do we do about the waste? The big question that people have is it safe to transport radioactive nuclear fuel rods by truck on highways?
Sure. So I think I'd like to, if you're okay with it, take a step back there just to talk a little bit about Nuclear Waste Management Organization and our project. And really start with the reason that we're investing time, effort, and really starting to engage almost 20 years in advance of this activity is really to protect people and the environment. So safety is really at our core. When it comes to the safety of transporting used nuclear fuel, there's actually a really strong international track record for transporting this type of material. And I understand people's concerns, but in over 50 years, that's close to six decades now, there have been more than 20,000 shipments worldwide of used nuclear fuel, and none has caused significant harm to people or the environment as a result of the release of radioactive materials. The other thing that I want to say about that is that transportation of used nuclear fuel is a highly regulated activity by Transport Canada and the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. It's actually the most highly regulated material on our roads today. And finally, I think it's also really important to note that used fuel is a solid material. Many people, when we first start talking to them, they think it's a liquid. In yellow barrels, when in fact it's a stable solid that can easily be contained by the required transportation packaging.
But like what happens? Okay, so the average person listening is like, okay, what happens if it's been safe and is regulated? Railways are regulated. We've seen Lac Mégantic. Airlines are regulated. We see disasters. People want to know what happens in the event of this, the worst case scenario. One of these trucks, there's a car accident, there's a storm, it jackknifes, there's a fire. What happens if that stuff, can it leave the truck? And what happens if it does?
Yeah, so firstly, I'd really like to talk about the packages that we'll be using to transport the used nuclear fuel. These are actually designed to meet international standards set by the International Atomic Energy Agency. So they have to undergo tests that simulate severe accident conditions like Lac Mégantic. So we have to put them through a drop test, a puncture test, a fire test. All of these happen consecutively to the same package to simulate maximum, or actually not to simulate, but to inflict maximum damage. There's also an underwater test, an immersion test that we have to do. In addition to that, several demonstrations have been done over the years to simulate accident scenarios. So there's actually a video on our YouTube site of a train going 160 kilometers an hour crashing into a package. So in all of these cases, the packages have remained intact and not released their contents. But going to your original question, Our goal will always be zero accidents as part of this program. That said, as part of the license to transport, which we must apply to the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission for, we will need to develop extremely detailed security and emergency response plans. So those plans outline roles, responsibilities, and actions that need to be taken in the event of any incident, so that we're prepared for anything and everyone knows what their roles and responsibilities are in the event of an incident.
Okay. I guess the other question is maintenance. Like someone, you know, this happens in all these things. Well, we had these safety, they passed their inspections years ago, but they were not maintained. There'd been a flaw, something happened, there were cuts, there was a human error, whatever the proposed and foreseen disaster. And this truck, like in the event that the truck breaks apart, what would happen if some of a spent radioactive rod sort of left the highway, the container breaks open, and it's in a field? Does that, is that a nuclear disaster, or is it a solid material that can quickly be, you know, contained?
Yeah, so it is a solid material that, that can quickly be contained. I think to your first question about maintenance, the nuclear industry, as I said before, is a highly regulated industry. So there will be operational controls in place and a really rigorous quality management system, something that, I mean, compared to other industries, when I came into this industry, I was just shocked by the amount of the number of checks and balances.
Right.
So there's that piece to it.
By the way, where do we do them now? Like, we have nuclear stations. How does the spent nuclear fuel rods travel now? By truck?
Yes, yeah, by truck. So there are approximately five shipments a year that happen in Canada by truck. However, our plan at this point, and I know, I mean, we talked about it being preliminary, we're still 20 years out, we're looking at two different transportation systems. So we're looking at the possibility of doing an all-road transport, but we're also looking at a road-rail combination. So just as a flag, it's we're still waiting to basically have a site selected in order to be able to determine the mode.
Now, because I just got a minute here, apparently eventually this stuff gets stored in some cave, a $23 billion cave. Like, where is this? You just basically bury it in the ground? Where is that?
Yeah, so the Deep Geological Repository, which is actually there's international consensus among leading scientists that this is the safest approach to move used nuclear fuel underground to a deep geological repository. We're looking at two potential sites at this point. One site is the South Bruce area. And the other site is the Ignace area in northwestern Ontario. And I think it's really important to note that the most important consideration for site selection is a strong partnership that can be developed with interested communities, First Nation and Métis communities in the area.
How deep would this thing be? How deep is the hole?
The hole itself, or I guess the Deep Geological Repository itself, is about the height of the CN Tower.
Wow. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, look, I mean, it's not, we're doing it now, but we're talking about something, a discussion we need to have on 30,000 shipments of nuclear waste, but not till in the 2040s. Caitlin Burley, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, Manager of Transportation Engagement. Caitlin, thanks for giving us some information about this. I think people need to understand the context of all the decisions were being made. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And really looking forward to hearing what people have to say. One of the reasons why we're engaging early is because because people ask for it, but we also want them to be involved in this process and let us know how they what they think and how
they're
thinking.
All right. Well, guess what, people? Let us know. 71010. Do you like that idea or not? 71010. Stephen Marsh, he's got a new book called The Next Civil War. He's on the other side of a break. You don't want to miss this.
Helping you through these unique times, this is The Evan Solomon Show.
The United States is coming to an end. The question is how. Every government, every business, every person alive will be affected by the answer. So opens the next civil war. Dispatches from the American Future, a new book dropped by Stephen Marsh, who's a well-known writer, novelist. He's written in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Globe and Mail, the New Yorker. And this new book is absolutely provocative. It's made a lot of news when Stephen wrote a piece for the Globe and Mail about this. And he joins me now about his new book. What a pleasure to have you, Stephen. Thank you, sir.
Nice to be here, Evan.
You don't start the book pulling punches, Stephen. I mean, it is. Yeah. It's the real deal. You know, the first question that everyone has is, this is an alarmist book about the end of the United States, something that has been predicted since the beginning of that democratic experiment, and people who bet against the U.S. lose. What's your response?
Well, I mean, it depends when you bet. I mean, if you bet in the 1850s on whether there would be a civil war, you would be right. I mean, I've been called alarmists quite a bit, certainly by my editors and when I and certainly by a lot of people that I try to. But, you know, there are tanks on the streets of Washington on July the 4th, and there's the January 6th riots. So it's becoming a little easier to convince people that this is actually happening and that these trends tend to go one way. This is not a question of betting for or against America. This is really a question of showing the best available models and where they tend and where they look like they're going.
Yeah, let's talk about the book, because I just want people to appreciate, because the headlines are a bit misleading. Let's talk about the scenarios and what this book really is. Tell us the idea behind it and how you're kind of, what models you're using to look into the future of the U.S., Stephen Marsh.
Well, I mean, I take different scenarios. So like a sheriff who decides to flout authority, an assassin who kills a president, what a hurricane arriving in New York would look like. And essentially I try and show what those immediate futures would look like by a wealth of evidence. And so there are about 200 interviews in the book. There are like lots of, well, not in the book, but that was what it was done to do the book. And then there are general models of what these things look like, basically showing how close America is to a violent future. So it's speculative nonfiction. It's really like showing what's going to happen, but it's very much backed up by facts and by models and by research and by reporting.
So let's go to some of these models. I'm here with Stephen Marsh. His new book is called The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. So walk us through sort of one or a couple of these five scenarios that you're talking about. Scenario one, what could lead potentially to an American civil war?
Well, I mean, the factors, America is a textbook case of a country headed towards civil war. It has hyperpartisanship at an extreme level. It has inequality at levels that are really kind of unprecedented. I mean, they are the highest levels on record in the United States since the founding of the country. You know, real French Revolution kind of levels of inequality. You have environmental degradation. You have the decline of faith in institutions. And you have, so those are sort of the ripe conditions for what is precipitant, like an incipient civil war. You know, the specifics of how it will come, like I imagine those scenarios, but really those are ways of highlighting the trends that are underlying them. And the trends that are underlying them are, you know, decline of faith in institutions. You know, by 2040, 30% of the country will control 68% of the Senate. You have a radical decline in faith in political institutions. And you also have only 20% of Americans think their electoral system represents the popular will. And over a third of Americans believe that violence is sometimes necessary to use against your own government. Those are the conditions that lead to mass political violence.
One of the things you do throughout the book, speaking of Stephen Marsh, The Next Civil War, is you look back at the first Civil War there, the bloody Civil War, and one of the fascinating things you write about is that on one end of the telescope, it looked like no one believed it could happen, and you flip the telescope and it seemed inevitable. What do we learn from the first Civil War in America that you think applies today, that resonates today?
Well, then as now, I think the trends are very easy to see. Like, you know, it's a textbook case. Like, the stuff in this book is not really controversial. Like, it's widely accepted modeling, and like, you know, it's not particularly complicated when you read it to see where things are going. But no one wants to look it in the face, and no one can really kind of believe that it's going to happen. Hence your question, aren't you just being alarmist at the beginning of this chat? Like, you know, people don't want to see what happened. And that's exactly what happened in the first Civil War. I mean, Fort Sumter was really not considered a major event in its time. Like Jefferson Davis said, you know, it's probably nothing. No one predicted violence. And of course, in hindsight, it's easy to say, well, you know, there was the nullification crisis, and there was Bloody Kansas, and there was the slavery issue, which could not be resolved, and it had to be resolved by violence. You know, we're in a very similar situation where the trends are all facing one way, but, you know, at the same time, no one can quite believe that it's going to happen.
Do you believe, I mean, these are scenarios, and we'll get to it as I speak to Stephen Marsh about this.
Yeah.
It's not inevitable, though, is it?
No. I mean, what I believe is that there's a 67% chance of it happening.
Right? That's pretty specific, now, Stephen.
Well, that's this book is very specific. Like, this situation is too critical and too important to not be incredibly accurate and precise about, as precise as possible. And, you know, so 67% is the number derived from a host of experts and also from a series of polls of what Americans think. And it's roughly what I agree with, too. And so, you know, I don't want to be alarmist. I think the numbers themselves are alarming enough. You know what I mean? Like the key thing here is to face the reality in the
so, so give us a, just walk us through, walk the listeners through how you arrive at such a precise number.
Well, foreign policy, their poll of, I think it was 100, that specific number, it was 100 experts on Civil War, where they asked them to rate it on a scale from 1 to 100, the likelihood. So it was like a meta-analysis of Civil War scholars giving their opinion about it. And then the other one was a simple poll that asked Americans to rate the chances, and then they extrapolated that to get that number. So that's like, the number is not out of my head. It comes from, you know, a series of experts and also popular opinion, which happened to coincide. So.
And give us a sense of the timeline. Like, what are we talking about here?
Well, I don't know the time. And just like I imagine these scenarios, but I'm also very clear that I'm imagining. Right. Again, this is too important to kind of to say things that I don't know. Right. I only say what I actually think I know. Right. But, you know, the number that does come up a lot in my head anyway is the year 2040. That's the year when it's predicted that America will become a majority minority white country, which, you know, when dominant ethnic groups tend to lose their dominance, that is a predictor of violence across the world. It happens in India. It happens in Africa. It happens all over the world. And it's happening in America. And that's also, I think, when the American democratic system will really be transparently no longer democratic. I mean, one number is 30% of the population will control 68% of the Senate, but that same stat says that 50% of the country will control 85% of the Senate. So in that case, you know, you're not really talking about a democracy anymore, and it will be totally obvious to everyone that that's the case. So, you know, I don't give predictions, I don't give dates, but 2040 is a scary number.
2040 is a scary number. The next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, Stephen Marsh, who talks about it. This is a book that has recently been reviewed by the New York Times and the Atlantic, and this is getting a lot of attention. And I want to keep you around, if I can, Stephen, for another sure. block, because there are preparations being done in the United States based on this stuff. You're not making this up. The U.S. Internally, the military is worried about this stuff. Politicians are worried about this stuff. For those people, and I asked the question at the beginning of the program, at the interview with Stephen, is this alarmist? Well, of course, when you put, there's going to be a civil war in the United States, it's hype. Hang on. There's data here. And when you go through the book, you realize that the scenarios are being imagined at the highest levels of the American government. So we'll speak more with Stephen Marsh, The Next Civil War, his new book, next. Stay with us.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
The next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, is the new book by the well-known novelist, writer, Stephen Marsh. You probably read him in The Walrus or The Globe or The New York Times or The Wall Street Journal or The New Yorker or The Atlantic. And this is his new book. And it is what they call speculative nonfiction, where he has done tremendous amount of research to imagine scenarios about a civil war in the United States. Is that democracy cracking? And are we just too unwilling to look at what's right in front of us, potentially a society on the brink of another civil war? Now, what would that civil war look like? It's not going to look like the first one, but it is an absolute pleasure to have Stephen Marsh on the program to talk about it. When you're talking about a civil war, what kind of scenarios are you imagining? Are you literally imagining a North versus South like we saw in the 1860s?
No. War of all against all, chaos, insurgency, political tribalism, fracturing into millions of pieces. When you look at contemporary civil wars, they're not really wars of sides necessarily, or the sides become quite confused quite quickly and fragment quite quickly. They're the forces of order against chaos, and chaos wins. What I'm describing here, like what it would look like, is the normalization of political violence. And when the normalization of political violence happens, the peaceful transition of power becomes completely impossible, and politics essentially becomes a game of spoils.
So tell me what, as you're looking at it, I'm trying to see the chaos that I cover as a political journalist this stuff all the time. And, you know, the error that political journalists make is that our nose is so close to the events, we never get the big picture, right? It's just event after event after event, and we actually miss the story, the forest for the trees problem. What are we missing?
Well, I think, like, to me, when I hear horse race politics, like when I hear, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene's Twitter feed, or Ted Cruz said this on Fox or whatever. I mean, I just don't care, because, like, I don't even really believe that a Trump election in 2024 would matter much, or either way. One of the hardest arguments that I make in this book, that's hardest for people to accept, is that I really believe everything in it would be true if Hillary Clinton were elected in 2016.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. Because what we're dealing with here are demographic trends, environmental trends, economic trends that totally transcend and lie well below the level of electoral politics. And I think that, like, the problems that America faces are structural. It's not a question of if only we get X into power, everything will be fine. And I think Democrats are starting to figure that out. Biden's in power, they control the Senate and Congress, and the country is still going the wrong way. It is still sliding into violence. And it's also hard to tell what can be done from Biden's point of view. I think that losing the forest for the trees is exactly what happens to political journalists, because what is happening is, like, we create these dramas around what matters, around these, like, small political dramas. We love these things. They're like, you know, they lead shows. Everything works around them. They don't really matter much. After writing this book, like, they don't seem to matter much to me. Right. What matters is that, like, it doesn't matter if Trump is elected or not in 2024 if by 2040 the Senate is not a legitimate body, right? Like, the legitimacy of the institutions are rotting, and when that goes, it really doesn't matter who's in power.
How in the research you did, Stephen Marsh, at what levels are people in power, military people, politicians in the United States, not only aware of that, of this situation, but tuned into the fragility of all this? Like, are you a voice in the dark, or are people saying, "Oh man, we've been measuring the strength of our democracy. We have lots of tools to measure resilience of institutions all over the world. We've applied that to America." You're right. The body politic is rotten.
Well, I mean, there are other writers who are making this argument that a civil war is coming. I mean, it's not, I'm certainly not alone. I think for the older liberal politicians, your Chuck Schumers, your Joe Bidens, they just have this faith in institutions, in American institutions, in the Constitution, that they they cannot shake, even though they can see it failing right in front of their eyes. This is like this absurd debate around the filibuster in the Senate. I mean, you're talking about a rotten institution. You should do whatever you can to reform it quickly. But they have this, they still have in their heads these traditions that are long since exploded, like long since stopped really being meaningful. And so, you know, I kind of both. Like, I do think there's certainly no lack of people in the military, particularly the military are very conscious of it because they've been fighting counterinsurgency for 70 years, and they know what counterinsurgency looks like, and they know what that it's impossible to fight, that you can't, you either cannot lose or you can completely lose. You can't really win. And so, like, they're very worried about it. But in terms of, like, people in power who can actually reform the system, understanding that the system needs to be reformed at a very profound level, at the level of constitutional convention, I mean, that's almost nobody.
What if this scenario applies to the United States, how does it apply to Canada?
It doesn't apply. I think there's this Canadian bad habit where it's like we're just as bad as the Americans. And of course, you know, we're not better people in any way, but our system is not even remotely comparable to the in terms of its stability to the Americas. I mean, our system is very stable. People believe in the Supreme Court here in a way that they simply have lost faith in the United States. And when you lose that faith in law, terrible things follow. History is very, very clear on that. So, you know, we have a lot to worry about. We need to figure out how we're going to deal with the fallout from this since we're so intertwined with them. And I mean, I literally think every CEO, every senior member of a cabinet, every leader in Canada needs to be thinking about that question. But sometimes I go and shows people like, well, we're just as bad here. It's like, no. It's very, very bad there. The two countries aren't comparable in that way.
All right. The book is just out. It's just remarkable how the pickup on it, because the anxiety is real. And I wonder, we're looking at the situation in Ukraine and, of course, the rise of China. You know, America's enemies are weaponizing this anxiety, aren't they? Now, I'm not blaming you for it. I'm just saying they're seeing this.
Oh, I don't think they're weaponizing the anxiety. They're weaponizing the reality, which is that, you know, America as it declines is stepping back from the world because it's dealing with its own chaos, right? I mean, and, you know, and it affect, you know, American chaos during the, I mean, America could not appoint diplomats because of hyperpartisanship until December. They didn't have, for much of the Trump years, they didn't effectively have a State Department. Right. But like less than, I think it was only a third of positions were filled at the State Department. So, of course, that's going to give, that gives Russia a freedom it never had before to operate. Right. And China, of course, this is all gravy to them.
The next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, is a fascinating new book by the always provocative and interesting Stephen Marsh. Hey, Stephen, thanks for joining us for this amount of time.
Your
this
pleasure.
Is an absolutely fascinating book, raising the questions. Frankly, nobody wants to face, and you're doing it in a great way, as always. Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much. Ciao.
Yeah, that's Steve Marsh. That does it for our program today. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network. Catch me on Power Play tonight at 5 p.m. Eastern on CTV News Channel. Wow. Food for thought, as always, on The Big Show. Thanks.